creating cultural awareness and understanding. This is Culture Click. Culture Click is written and produced by KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University.
Members of the Phi Beta Sigma fraternity started off this year's 34th annual Soul Food Dinner at Winona State University. The Harlem Renaissance was this year's Soul Food Dinner theme, a cultural and artistic movement that started within the black neighborhoods of New York City in the 1920s and 30s. The Harlem Renaissance sought to celebrate the thoughts and ideas of black poets, musicians, authors, and artists. In addition to the dinner, there was a performance of Ebony Embers' Vignettes of the Harlem Renaissance, which featured poetry of Langston Hughes, County Cullen, and Claude McKay, and the music of Duke Ellington, Billy Strayhorn, and Jeffrey Mumford, among others. The performance consisted of a solo actor and a cello piano percussion trio. I was able to speak to the cellist Tahira Whittington and actor Chris White to talk about their touring performance and the importance of sharing the lives of these seminal men with audiences. I'm Anna Flores, and you're listening to Culture Click. You're listening to KQAL, this is Culture Click, and I'm speaking with one of the musicians that play tonight at the Harlem Renaissance event. Can I have you introduce yourself and where you're from?
Sure, my name is Tahira Whittington. I'm the cellist of the core ensemble. We just finished doing one of our chamber music theater pieces of Ebony Embers' Vignettes of the Harlem Renaissance. And we all are from different parts of the country. The percussionist Michael Parola lives in Florida. The pianist Xiaoling Lin and I live in Chicago. And the actor Chris White lives in New York.
How did you feel bringing alive these songs that these great musicians created?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's amazing because these, we consider these pieces classics of the jazz era and the bebop era, and they've been testament to their greatness that they've lived through all of this time, as well as the beautiful poetry that the actor says in the show.
And what kind of challenges did you find trying to recapture those songs or poets or...
It was great. It was, well, for some of the things, we didn't have a recording to just hear how the musicians interpreted themselves. But for the most part, we did. So we got their original interpretation of the songs, but we were able to put our spin on it and make it our own once we got it into our hands.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And what was your favorite part about performing around the country? Haven't you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I think just meeting the different kinds of people that you see on the road, performing for different kinds of audiences, and we all always get like an appreciation for the show everywhere we go. In some instances, we've even gotten people who were students of County Cullen and students of Aaron Douglas.
Wow.
So we've been able to meet them on the road as we perform this all across the country.
And what do you hope your audiences take away from your performances?
Well, we hope that we spark an interest. Some of these poets, especially the younger generation, they don't know about them because they're not taught in schools or they're taught singularly and not a part of this great Harlem Renaissance period. So I hope it sparks an interest for them to go and search on their own about the period as well as the individual figures that we highlighted.
And when did the Harlem Renaissance span? What were the years?
It was around 1919, early 1920s into mid-1930s.
Okay, yeah. And how did it disseparate? I mean,
it dissipated because of, well, the Great Depression set in 1929, and so the financial sponsorship that was going on between white patrons and the African-American artists was dwindling.
Mm-hmm.
And also the artists themselves, they didn't want to become figures or continue to be figures of propaganda just to uplift the race. They wanted to be poets and artists in their own right.
Right.
And so they started to evolve and grow in that right as well.
Was the Harlem Renaissance only sectioned in New York, or did
no.
it spread?
No, it was all over. It was in Detroit, Chicago, Washington, D.C. had a big gathering of artists there. So they call it the Harlem Renaissance. Actually, during the time, it was called the Negro Renaissance.
Okay.
But they've isolated it, you know, just as far as the teaching goes at the Harlem Renaissance because it was such a flowering in that city.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the city of New York.
Okay, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
This is Anna Flores, you're listening to KQAL, and I'm here with the actor for tonight. Can I have you introduce yourself and where you're from?
Hi, I'm Chris White. I live in New York City, but I'm originally from Charlotte, North Carolina. And I played four artists of the Harlem Renaissance. the painter Aaron Douglas, poet Claude McKay, who was originally from Jamaica, Langston Hughes, whom many of us are very familiar with, and County Cullen.
Okay, and tell me a little bit about the Harlem Renaissance. When did it begin and how did it grow?
Oh, well, there's no official start date, but it basically started around 1919. And what happened was W.E.B. Du Bois, who was one of the leaders of the NAACP, or NAACP, he realized that the best way to make some civil rights happen for black people in America was to arrange a literary movement, where another leader of the movement, James Weldon Johnson, said the only way people can be great is if they produce literature. So Johnson and Dr. Du Bois got together and they started selecting poems and other pieces of work from young writers who were very talented that were submitting their pieces to the magazines that they produced. And so basically that's how it got started. And then some other writers like Claude McKay, he became friends with white editors, and that brought some attention to black writers as well. And so the attention basically started with the literary world, and as more literature was produced, white America and the world became more familiar with the reality of black life in America.
What kind of audience was the Black Renaissance directed towards, or who enjoyed it?
Well, that's a good question. Primarily, it was directed towards black America. Dr. Du Bois wanted the writers of the Renaissance to produce pieces that reflected black America in a very respectable light. Of course, for years, and this is the early 20th century, so right before, you know, we were only about 80 years away from slavery, if that, well, 60 years from slavery. So all the media images and the social images of black Americans were very negative. Lazy people who don't work and good for nothing, and they're stupid and uncultured. So Dr. Du Bois wanted the pieces to reflect an upright, upstanding citizenship of black people who were the clean-cut, church-attending, working kind. However, and the writers, and to some degree, some of them did produce work that was like that, but as the Renaissance went on and as the writers developed as artists themselves, they started writing pieces that reflected the nitty-gritty of black life. Claude McKay wrote Home to Harlem, which was very much about the street lives in Harlem, you know, things that you wouldn't talk about in church or at a polite tea party. You know, those are the things that these writers started to write about. And Dr. Du Bois got very upset with that because he felt like the movement was being hindered and progress for black Americans was being hindered because of this nitty-gritty reality.
I had heard some criticism that, you know, the black Renaissance artists were assimilating into white culture. Mm-hmm. And do you have anything to say about that?
Gosh, that's a really good question, too. They did not assimilate into white culture. I think a better way of looking at it is they walked a very fine line. Some of the writers, well, a lot of the writers were, of course, inspired by great European writers like Donne and men like that, Shakespeare. And so basically what happened with them, with black writers here, was that they were attracted to this form of poetry or this certain form of prose writing, and they started to imitate that. Claude McKay, the Jamaican, he started imitating that. But what he did was he blended the rural dialect of Jamaicans, poor farmer Jamaicans, you know, up in the hills, and he married that with the form of Western European literature. And Langston Hughes pretty much did the same thing as he grew. Basically, when he got to his mid-20s, he started writing more poetry that was formatted after Western European literature. But he started to include a lot of blues rhythms and, you know, black slang and things like that. The only writer I think that you could say assimilated into white society was County Cullen and Jesse Fawcett, because they wrote very polite things. County Cullen wrote a lot of things that were in the style of the great European masters. Jesse Fawcett's literature was all about the upper echelon of black society, so her works reflected a very, very, very small minority of black Americans at the time.
How did it feel to recapture these great poets, authors?
It's a phenomenal feeling. I mean, the first thing that jumped out to me was how persistent and strong-willed these men were. You know, many of them were born in the 1890s, the early 1900s, and they had tremendous obstacles in front of them. You know, social obstacles, family obstacles, financial obstacles, and yet they persisted. They were a little different. They followed this voice inside of them that drew them to literature, and they followed that voice, and they didn't pay as much attention to all the voices outside of them that were telling them they couldn't produce work, they would never get published, you know, they had nothing to say. And so that inspired me to take my life a little more seriously. You know, today it's very easy for Americans of any color to, you know, just kind of skate through life. You know, we're born and, you know, our parents are presumably kind of well off and, you know, they'll take care of us. And then we go to college and we do all these things that we're supposed to do. And we don't have to work nearly as hard as these men and women did. So that was one thing. I guess that's a more humbling experience. And then another thing was just it's empowering to realize that these people followed their own voices and they wrote their own work, they produced their own work. And even when the times got rough and when it looked like, you know, they may not have money to get back to Europe, to America, you know, they're stranded in Europe, they still followed their own voice. And they paid more heed to that than anything else. So that's very empowering, you know, as I go into my 30s, just to remember that just follow my own voice and God's voice, too, as I venture through life.
And what do you hope your audiences take away from your performances?
I hope they take away a sincere interest in at least one of these men, and they go home and they start reading some of their works, or at least find out more about their lives. They lived very amazing lives. I'm still reading about these men, and I'm still blown away by the things I learn about them. And for the younger people, you know, my age and younger, I hope that they walk away with a sense of empowerment and that ability to just trust their own voice and to keep working and keep going no matter what.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We would like to thank cellist Tahira Whittington and actor Chris White from Of Ebony Embers, Vignettes of the Harlem Renaissance, for their insight on the rich cultural movement of the 1920s and 30s. Tune in right here any Thursday afternoon at 12:30 for more Culture Click.
Creating cultural awareness and understanding. You've been listening to Culture Click. Support for Culture Click is made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Culture Click is produced by KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University. For more information, look us up on the web at kqal.org. And thanks for listening to Culture Click.